is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Let me take a moment to let everyone know about the upcoming BTS Summit in St. Louis on September 27th and 28th. If you haven't heard, BTS is a comprehensive program for running a long-term, profitable, high-quality youth basketball training company. It allows someone to have a career in youth basketball, helping young people become the best they can be both on and off the court. I am honored to have Larry Hughes, 13-year NBA veteran and a co-founder of BTS, here to tell us what this summit is all about. Larry, tell us about the upcoming summit and what it's all about.
Mike, thanks and congratulations on your Hoop Heads podcast. We established the summit to provide people interested in building a successful youth basketball program the opportunity to come in for 2 days of learning what we do, how we do it, and how they can apply our system to grow their programs. In March, I opened up our 16,000 square foot facility with leading technology used by several NBA teams, which tracks every shot, every movement on the court, allowing us to objectively assess the progress of our members. People who join the summit will get a chance to use the technology and learn how we integrate it into our programs. We will have David Martin, recently head analytics of the 76ers, speak about direction of technology in basketball. We will also have presentations and workshops on how to effectively build back office systems to create memorable experiences for members and build long-term value in the business. We want to empower the attendees to take their basketball organizations to the next level. So the first 30 signups get to participate for free. Thereafter, it's $199 per person. We have arranged discounted hotels in the area. The event also offers the opportunity to network with others in similar circumstances. We're excited to provide this opportunity to market and think that all attendees will get extraordinary value for attending.
Larry, the summit sounds great. Where can people go to learn more and get signed up?
They can go to basketballtrainingsystems.com/summit to learn more or call us at 301-602-3001.
Thanks, Larry. I'm hoping to make it out to St. Louis myself.
The Hop. I feel that it's taken our program to a whole nother level. We're in the dead center of Central California. We don't have the populations of the Bay Area or Orange County. We don't have the mega privates with 2,500 to 3,500 kids and 6'3 studs, all Americans walking around. We have to be able to do some things differently, because just doing what they do at a lesser rate, we're not going to be successful. So we put a lot of time into our defense, put a lot of time into our shooting. And we're going to have, I think, 14 kids playing college basketball next year. I believe it's 9 at the Division I level, between freshmen through seniors in college next year. And most of those are shooters. I think it's taken our poor shooters and made them average to good and good to great.
Craig Campbell is the girls' head varsity basketball coach at Clovis West High School in Fresno, California. Craig just finished his 25th season and has won 601 games in his coaching career. Under Craig's guidance, Clovis West has been one of the top teams in three-point shooting in the state of California for the past 6 years, and also one of the tops in the country. Several D1 and D2 schools recruit shooters from Clovis West. Clovis West is one of only 2 or 3 schools in California that teach hop shooting throughout their program, and Craig considers it to be a huge asset for his team and a key cog in their shooting success. Clovis West has 127 wins over the last 4 years, including being selected #1 in the country in 2017. 7 kids received Division I rides from that team. Craig's daughter Madison shattered all of Clovis West's scoring and three-point shooting records last season and was the first player in school history to be first-team All-State all 4 years, and was also an All-American her senior year. She will be a freshman at USC this fall. Craig has a network of college coaches that he is constantly giving and taking shooting drills from, and many D1 schools borrow his drills after coming and watching a Clovis West practice. After you're finished listening to the show, hop over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating and review to help others in the basketball community find the Hoopheads podcast. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. You can find every episode we've ever recorded on our website, www.hoopheadspod.com. Be prepared with a pencil and a pad of paper so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Craig Campbell from Clovis West High School in Fresno, California.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Clovis West High School in California, Craig Campbell. Craig, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are excited to dive into all of the things that you've been able to do in the game. You have kind of a unique situation coaching your daughter, who's going to be playing at USC this coming season. So we'll get into that as we move into the podcast. Want to start by going backwards in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about what it was about the game of basketball that you remember most and what made you fall in love with it when you were a young kid.
You know, it's funny. I picked up, I had two older brothers, picked up every sport, every ball you could possibly put your hands on. And they were 8 and 6.5 years older. So I was always, you know, significantly smaller or weaker than them until a certain point in time. And just loved to compete, loved anything that had competition with it. And so, you know, I just think the 5-on-5, the transition of offensive, defensive basketball, I was probably maybe most talented as a quarterback. But my love was always basketball. And so I think just that being able to play both sides, and the speed of the game, grew up in Reno, Nevada. So being indoors was always nice versus playing football in the snow. So growing up, spending all the time out in the driveway, wearing out our hoop, driving our neighbors crazy from an early age all the way through. And, just had that instant passion for the game.
How much do you think that being the youngest of your siblings had an impact? Because I think that birth order thing is always something that's interesting to me when you think about being the youngest and always having to chase, and as you mentioned, being smaller, weaker, and not as fast as your older brothers. How much of an impact do you think that had on your competitiveness and just wanting to keep up with them?
You know, I think there's a couple advantages. You know, assuming that the youngest one has the interest in it, you know, you're fighting an uphill battle all the time. So you have to kick, bite, and scratch just to compete. And plus you get exposed to it at an earlier age. You're playing against dad when you're a little one isn't nearly like battling with your brother or your older sister. And so, you know, I think you get exposed to it. And I think that competitive drive is definitely, you're always fighting for respect. You're always fighting to tag along with them and their buddies, you know, and not be left at home. And so, you know, I think that definitely adds to the competitive drive that some of the younger ones build.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was the oldest in my family, and I only had a sister, never had a brother. But I was around lots of friends who had brothers, and I always found that dynamic to be fascinating just in terms of their ability to compete with one another and sometimes to their detriment, where they got a little bit too crazy and were beating each other up all the time. But I do think that by having older brothers in the house, I think that there's no doubt that sometimes pushes those younger brothers, like you said, if they have the interest, it pushes them to be successful and to be more competitive simply because of the fact that they have built-in competitors right there in the house. So as you're going through and you're looking at your time playing basketball, what was it as you got into your high school career? Can you talk to us about maybe one or two of the highlights, something that you remember? Now, obviously, as a high school coach, you're charged with helping your kids to have positive feelings and working on and making them better people and making them better basketball players. But what do you remember about your own high school career? What are one or two things that stand out for you as memories that you had from back in your playing days?
You know, I think obviously one part is the teammate connection. Still friends with all my teammates from high school, and just some of the things that you go through, road trips and practices and tough practices. And I remember we were a part of my junior year. We were the number 3 seed. The number 1 team in Vegas. Nobody wanted to play them, and so we wanted to win the third place game, not have to play them. And we win. We're all excited. We found out the number 1 team got upset. Now we got to play the number 1 team in the state in the first round of the state playoffs. And this team, we could play them 1,000 times and lose by 25 plus. And we were down 25 going into the fourth quarter and outscored them 38-12 in the fourth quarter and ended up winning by 3. And wow. We could play that team another 1,000 times. And a funny story is a really good friend of mine one time said, "What's the greatest comeback you've ever been a part of?" And so I told him, he starts shaking his head, and I go, what? And he goes, I was an assistant coach on that team.
Wow.
And I said, I go, you idiot. How could you let your starters take their shoes off and be drinking Gatorade without this comeback? And so, you know, that you have that part of it, you know, a couple special games, you know, a career high scoring rebounding game. But I think the relationship piece with my teammates, and, you know, with social media today, you're able to kind of keep in touch better and rehash the old war stories, and had a lot of good in the last decade, a lot of great memories shared amongst my teammates.
Yeah, it's easy with your teammates, the bonds that you build when you're young and you're part of a team. And I think that's something that you look at other walks of life, and sports is the one area where, because of what you go through the physical grind of practices and just through the mental things that you go through as being part of a team, and just those experiences, like you said, with wins, losses, road trips, just being in close quarters with your teammates all the time. I think that there's no way to be able to duplicate that in any other walk of life besides team sports. And I think that those of us who grew up with team sports and eventually made our way into coaching, I think that one of the things that attracts us to sports is what you just described, which is those bonds and those relationships that we're able to build with teammates. And I'm guessing that as you look at where you are as a coach today, that forging those relationships, A, between you and your players, and then also helping foster relationships between your players, I'm guessing that's something that's pretty important to you at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, you know, we do a lot of things to foster and develop our culture. I assign vans for every trip. I never let It's always changing. So we'll travel with two or three teams together to tournaments in the summertime, and I'll have eighth graders sitting with starting seniors. And then the hotel rooms will also be assigned by me. And it's, if you're not getting along with somebody, guess what? You're going to be riding together. And if you're too much of a clique with somebody, you're not going to be spending much time with them. And so we really try to tear down those barriers, build any bridges that need mending. And we try to keep our program drama free. It's just, the littlest bit of cancer can just make a great experience miserable so fast. And so we're constantly trying to build that relational piece with our kids and making sure that, they respect one another.
How do you go about doing that on a day-to-day basis? So what does that look like? Now, you just described a couple things where you're on road trips, or you're on the van, you're on the bus, and you're having kids sit together with different people that maybe who they might normally interact with. But on a day-to-day basis, on the practice floor or in the school setting or outside of the school when you get together as a team, what are some of the things that you do to be able to build that camaraderie, to be able to build that team spirit?
Yeah, I mean, for just the relationship between me and the players, I think it's very important. You know, I really try to get our kids to understand that we care about them way more than just as an athlete. I can, you know, I try to touch base with what's going on in their personal life. If I see a kid really struggling in practice, or maybe we were too hard on them one day, they had just a lousy practice, I'll tend to call them in the next day or so during class and sit down and have a one-on-one with them and kind of make that better. Amongst the kids, you know, every part of our practice is competitive, and we try to really break down the cliques. And so we'll mix up our shooting groups daily. We'll rotate in who gets to go on to what team daily, but so it's not just always first team, second team. On team road trips, you know, part of the culture is the mentoring process. So when we have a young talented kid coming in, I'm going to put them with one of our better senior leaders that really gets the culture, so that they're training them in how we do things, how we enter a gym, how we behave, how we act when we enter a gym, how we watch film, just all the details of that. And so we spend so much time with our kids. I mean, it's really an 11-month program. And I mean, even the month they have off, they're in the gym with us a lot. So we just want that cycle to always be our foundation, is our culture.
How long did it take you to establish that in terms of getting it to the point where it was more of a player-led culture, where obviously you're overseeing everything, but as what you're describing is you have your older upperclassmen passing along the things of, hey, this is how we do things here. How long did it take you to get to that point where it wasn't always constantly you being the one who was directing that culture, but the players themselves were starting to police that culture? How long did it take you to get to that point?
You know, that's a great question. We had a group in a really talented team in 2010 with some very high achieving athletic and academic kids. And, you know, they were kind of the last group of a great group of leaders for a year. And we had some kids behind them that wanted all the glory, but they wanted to do different things besides achieve high in the classroom and achieve high on the court. And so their personal social choices weren't the best. And we ended up having five kids kind of lead a little revolt because they got disciplined on a trip for screwing up. And long story short, they got disciplined on a road trip and then tried to say, oh, it wasn't a big deal. My parents thought it was funny, and it was totally out of line by our standards. And so we drew a line in the sand and ended up losing five kids in the middle of a tournament out of town. And there were two starters, our sixth man and our eighth and ninth. So we lost a big middle core of talent. But there was no way we could continue the way this was going, and they weren't going to call the shots. And so we came back with a young team. In my opinion, we were probably fourth in talent in league that year. And once we got rid of that element, those kids, we went on to win league with about the fourth best talent in our league. And the buy-in from that point forward, the leadership is just, it's never wavered since. Everybody saw where the line was, and we weren't going to tolerate that kind of behavior in our program. And when they realized we were willing to move on from kids that were starting and may have cost us some games, everybody towed the line. And then from then forward, we started cultivating it and mentoring even more, pulling the leaders in and making sure that they understood what the expectation was. Sometimes checking in with the leaders and getting a pulse on the team. And then putting the kids in positions to lead. I mean, I don't have to tell them get into every drill. If I have a kid that I need to lead that's not doing it yet, I'll say, hey, such and such, get them in this drill. And so then she'll have to turn and organize and lead the team. So they're starting to hear her voice. She's starting to get more comfortable leading. And then it kind of feeds itself.
What are some of the things that, besides getting a kid to lead a drill, when you start talking about developing leaders on your team? And I guess I look at leadership kind of in a two-pronged way. Is you have leaders who are sort of your vocal leaders. They're people that, you know, are rah-rah and cheering the team on. And then you have the other piece of leadership, which I think is what you're describing, where you start to have your players hold accountable the other players for the culture or the way we do things or just understanding what it is that we're trying to get done X's and O's wise. So how do you develop those two sort of separate prongs, sort of the vocal leader and then the leadership from your older players or your better players, or, you know, again, could be your 12th player, that where they're going to hold each other accountable and say, hey, we're trying to live up to this standard where you're not doing it. How do you get players to hold each other accountable? What are some things that you do in that particular aspect?
Well, and yeah, there's a lot there. There's, you know, in a perfect world, your best player is your leader. And, you know, that makes it simple. Last year, Madison was hands down our best player. Last 2 years, she was our best leader. You know, she was our verbal, our work ethic, our cultural leader. She, you know, but that's not going to happen every year.
Right.
And some kids are, you know, lead by example, but they're not going to say anything. But if that's your best player, you still need to get them out of their comfort zone and start to speak more. Simple little things like when we're in the weight room, I'll walk by. We have a really nice group of kids back, but they're very quiet. And I'll walk by and kind of prod some of them about, hey, you know, hey, you're doing a great job. Have you said a word to a teammate yet? And they're kind of like, no. And then, it's
kind of like,
yeah. And so you're constantly trying to get them to be, you know, I'll tell them all the time, hey, this isn't my team. And the second it becomes your team, we're going to take off. But if I have to will you every day, if I have to be the rah-rah every day, if I have to provide all the leadership, that's also going to take away from my abilities as a coach to play the X and O game. And so you guys have to bring that to the table. And so we're real big on communication and practice. I mean, we're constantly talking through everything we do and trying to get that comfort zone, even with your quieter kids. We had a big thing with the last 2 years with this quiet group of it's one step to say it, but we want you to yell it. You're going to be in a packed gym, you know, just saying it sheepishly doesn't get the point across. And so, you know, just developing those things, just constantly, you know, I read and study a ton, trying to find any advantage, any new knowledge I can learn as a coach and then pass on to my players. So I'm constantly sending little things of leadership to our kids. I'll pull kids aside and talk about what a great job they did leading in this area, or they, you know, we kind of stumbled leading in this area. I'll pull a kid aside and say, hey, you know, I'm tired of watching kids straggle onto the floor before practice. They're not out there getting their ACL warm-up in and the other stuff. And I'll put the onus on them. Like if any kid steps onto the floor with their jersey untucked or jewelry in, rather than me disciplining that one kid, they're all running. We see one kid do it, they're all running. So now the kids, that's one area where the kids are policing each other, making sure they understand, hey, we don't wear jewelry on the floor. Hey, our jerseys are tucked in the second we walk in the gym, practice or game. And so trying to get them to take ownership in the lateral leadership part really helps. And then, you know, you always have to work extra with your captains. You got to understand your captains have to understand they're closer to the coaches than they are to the players in terms of how this is going to work. There's going to be times you have to do what's best for the team, and it's sometimes it's going to step on some feelings.
How do you go about picking your captains? I'm curious because I like hearing from different coaches about what their methodology is for selecting captains. Do you select the captains? Does a team select the captains? Is there a combination? Is there a vote? Do you have a meeting? How do you go about picking the players that are going to be your captains, or it's just become clear based on where you are in your program?
Well, it changed. I wish I could just say it's black and white, but it changes year to year. The last 2 years, we had three kids that were black and white, our captains. There was no question about it for anybody. If I had them vote, that's how it would have turned out. There's other years where if you let them vote, you know it's not going to be.
It's not going to go the way you want it to.
Yeah. And so there's been years I don't leave any input up to them because I don't trust the makeup of the team. Or I think there's a kid you need to lead that might not be the most popular one. And so usually in that situation, I'll pick them. I'll make sure one way or another that we're going to have the right captains. Sometimes I will this could be a great year where I might pick one or two and let the team vote for one or two. I prefer to have an odd number because I think if you have two or if you have four, you can have a split. You could have one person against one or two against two. When it's decision time or, you know, the stuff the team has to go through. So I prefer to have odd numbers, ideally three. That way, you know, two versus one, if there's ever a decision that's a tough decision for the group. Or I also feel comfortable if I have three that I've got one of the captains on the floor at all times.
So what are the roles for your captains? What do you expect them to do? And then how do you help them to make sure that they're going to do the things that you want them to do to help the program, help the team to be successful as you want them to be?
Well, I mean, one thing that's a non-negotiable is our captains can't be low achieving academically or any character issue, because I'm not going to, you can never, you know, you're the pinnacle of the program as a captain, and you're an ambassador for us, and you're the face that's going to be out there in the public and everybody's going to know. So it can't be a hypocrisy. I mean, I've had times where I've had a very talented kid that there is no way that they were fit up to be a captain. They might have even been our best player. But you can't, there's more than just talent that goes into that. And so we're constantly, you know, one, we, again, our mentorship program, we try to bond those future leaders up with the good leaders all along. I'll tell them, hey, take this kid under your wing, have them ready for next year when you're gone, so that they see the examples and they hear what's going on. Trying to establish the trust, confidence with what you, if you have to bring something to me that's for the betterment of the team, I'm not going to throw you under the bus and say, hey, Sally came and said that you did this or the team's doing this. But you know, that trust factor goes both ways. There's times I'm going to have to plant some seeds into the captain with what's going on or the behavior of a teammate or, you know, just in the best interest of the team. So there's just a lot of personal conversations that go on in trying to prep them for that and giving them responsibilities. You know, simple things like group text and stuff. I'll text the three captains and say, hey, we need to pick out, you know, from these three shoe styles tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. I need the shirt size of all the girls, and giving them responsibilities that they know that, you know, they take some pride in, get some ownership in, but sometimes I'll just let the captains choose the jersey color, the shirt color or whatever. So they get a little extra perks there too. So just trying to put them in those responsibility and positions and opportunities.
Head Start Basketball's Cutthroat Game Building Program debuts on Tuesday nights in September. players in grades 5 through 10, both boys and girls. You won't want to miss this one. Registration is open now at www.headstartbasketball.com.
When you first got there, from a culture standpoint, what were some of the things that you needed to do, the first steps as you were building the program? What do you remember back from that time in terms of how you had to get things going to get it to where you wanted to be today?
So I coached at Reno High School for 11 years prior to coming to Clovis West. And we were in the state championship game in 2000, 2001, and then 4 and 5. And we won it all in 2001. So we were 1 or 2 in the state for the last 6, 7 years up in Reno. And what was frustrating up there was I ran our middle school program every year, and it was a headache every year. Everybody fought me on it. Our program was too competitive for middle school. This middle school math teacher wanted a stipend and didn't want me coaching the 7th grade team, and just all these ridiculous, totally, you know, it goes against everything we teach competitively and athletically. And so what intrigued me to come down to Clovis West was they have a program like our feeder system. We have 7 elementary schools that go to 1 intermediate school that go to us. And so you have like a small town feel within a big town system. When I came down and interviewed and looked around the campus, everybody wants to be number one at everything. And in Reno, I was getting frustrated because everything was an excuse. Everybody wanted to cop out. You're almost regretted for working hard by some. And so it was refreshing to see a place where everybody was competitive and wanted to be number one. And so taking over here, they had just started a feeder AAU program. And so I looked at it as an opportunity, basically be as good as you are willing to work. The challenge was they weren't competing at the level of what I was leaving. And so these kids, I came in with, hey, who's the top dog? Well, that's who we're going to go beat. And we started going up the rankings right away. And these kids were like, coach, you know, doesn't the pressure bother you? Doesn't the bullseye bother you? And I instantly had to change their thinking. I said, no, when the bullseye's on our back, it means we're doing things right. And so, you know, I had to get these kids to understand the mindset of, you know, being the hunter, being the hunted, and, you know, embracing that your own personal expectation should never be surpassed by outside pressure or somebody else's expectation of you.
How did you go about engaging the greater community beyond just the people that were directly involved in your program? So how did you engage the school community? How did you engage the city itself and get people to get behind your program? Because obviously there's a piece of it that goes on within the team that's the most important piece, but there's also this greater piece of building a program that kids are going to aspire to, that people are going to want to come watch, that administration is going to be supportive of. So how did you go about building that piece of your program?
Well, you know, I think the old adage of, you know, you have to model what you're asking your kids to give rung true right away. I got hired in April, but still had to finish out my teaching year through June in Reno. And because we had a spring/summer program starting with my Clovis West kids, I would literally leave at lunch on Friday, race down here, have practice Friday night, play in a weekend tournament, and then drive 5 hours back home to Reno. And I did that pretty much every weekend, April through June. And so right away our kids saw, wow, this guy's serious. And for me, it was always, you know, either I'm all in or I'm all out. I'll never cheat the kids by hanging on when I can't give what I think they deserve. And so setting up the work ethic and commitment level, showing them how invested in them I was. Right away, I had a meeting with all the families of all the levels from 7th grade through varsity, told them my expectations, my thoughts, my ambitions. And then we run a lot of areas, like when I was in Reno, they had YMCA basketball, and a lot of areas have like little NJB or some little youth league. We have our own little league that we run. We call it our Little Hoopsters program, and we run it kindergarten through 6th grade. Kindergartners go 8 to 9. First grade goes 9 to 10. We had over 370 girls kindergarten through 6th grade this year that are all our kids. And so from there, we'll pick our AAU teams and that's through eighth grade. And one of the great compliments I get from people in our community a lot is, you know, you won my daughter over in first grade when you knew her by name. You saw her in the grocery store and you high-fived her and said, hey, Susie, I can't wait for you to play for me. And I look around and we only have one university here. And yeah, it's great to support Fresno State and support the local, Fresno Pacific. We have Division I, Division II universities here, but I want our kids wearing Clovis West. I want elementary school kids wearing Clovis West, not UConn. And so we're very, very involved in our articulation program. And I oversee our coaches all the way through third grade. It's my high school staff that coaches our AAU program, so it's not outsiders. And so we're just really, really invested in, we'll be in a summer league with our fourth team, which is basically our incoming eighth graders, and our entire high school staff, you'll have seven coaches sitting on the bench, or eight coaches sitting on the bench. And so, you can't do something this big by yourself. I've got fantastic people with me. But it's really the investment of all those. I think parents, and they say it all the time, I mean, they just sit back and look at the investment in our staff into their children, and that's where they fall in love with it.
Love that. So I have two things I want to ask you about from what you just said. One, do your varsity, junior varsity players get involved at all with your youth players in terms of the league and those 370 kids who are participating from kindergarten through sixth grade? Do your varsity high school players go down and get involved with those elementary kids?
Yeah. So I'm sorry, I left that part out actually. So on our little Hoopsters program, every high school kid, that becomes their Saturday practice through January and February. So every high school player for us is assigned two teams. So, you know, the older kids get to pick what shift they want first, and, you know, the freshmen get what's left over.
I love that. I grew up in a system where we had that same thing where the high school players coach the elementary school kids. And I loved it as an elementary school kid because the guys that I would go and watch on Friday night were the guys that were coaching me. And so to be able to kind of touch your heroes, there's nothing better than that. And then as I got to high school, I could turn around and do the same thing for the younger kids that, you know, were coming up behind me. And I always felt like that was a great way to be able to build a program. And at least around here in Ohio, I don't see that nearly as much. I think it was pretty much standard issue back in the time when I was a kid in the, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s. And now I don't see it as much. And I hear you talk about what you're doing there. And to me, it just makes so much sense in terms of setting up a situation where those girls who are in kindergarten through sixth grade, by being able to have a personal relationship with some of the players that are part of the high school program, to me, there's no better way to inspire those girls to want to be a part of something special when they get to the high school and to motivate them to want to be basketball players and want to be a part of it. And I think that that's one of the first things that I would tell any high school coach is if you want to be able to build a good feeder system, I think you have to have your players involved so that the kids who are coming up behind them can see and have something to aspire to. And I think that's critical to being able to build the kind of program that you want to have as a high school coach. And I think it's something that we've gotten away from it because in a lot of places you'll see where parents are doing a lot of the coaching and, you know, people are sometimes hesitant to turn over that coaching job to a 15 or 16 year old. And as a result of that, I don't think you get the same kinds of results like what you're describing. I think it's just, it creates a special memory. It creates a special bond between those kids that are all part of the same school district. And it just sets up this pipeline of girls, in your case, who want to be eventually part of your high school program.
Yeah, and you know, you brought up another great point. I have an assistant that spent some time coaching locally at a rival school of ours, and then he had retired, and he and I just knew each other by face but never really knew each other. And we sat down, I was scouting a playoff game one time, and he was just watching as a fan, and we ended up sitting by each other, and I was talking to him and talked him into coming back out and coaching, and we just hit it off. So anyway, he's a month into his first season with our varsity, and he goes, one day he stops me after practice, he goes, "Now I get it." And I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, everybody always complains that Clovis West just wins because they're so talented. Then they get all the shooters, they get all this. He goes, I thought we were working hard at my old school. We weren't doing anything compared to you. But your kids see what it looks like because the older ones, the talent level, they've won before. Our kids don't have that model of what it looks like. And so, you know, to be able to reach out and touch it, to be able to see it, you know, our incoming kids know what it looks like to, you know, and you go and play against our top five varsity. Okay. You lost by 80, you're 80 points from being varsity good, you know, and just getting them to see what that commitment works like. And when your best players don't ever miss practice and never dog a drill and never talk back, you know, they see what it looks like.
I love it. The other thing that I pull out of what you've been saying is you mentioned how you're in the grocery store and you see somebody and you give that little girl who's 8 years old a high five and you know their name and the impact that that has on that little girl, but not only that, but on her family who's with her. And I think it gives people an idea of the investment that you as the high school coach is making in not just your high school team, but the entire program from K all the way through 12. And I don't think that can be underestimated. And I think the key here that I hear you saying, and you're not saying it directly, but if you're going to be successful as a high school coach, the amount of time that you have to put in and invest into your program, I think the average person who is, even if you're a parent of a middle school or a high school basketball player, you may not understand the amount of time that a coach puts in. And now you're talking about investing in your youth program, which again is not directly your high school. It's not coaching your high school team. It's not preparing X's and O's for your high school team. It's not watching film and scouting for your high school team. It's nothing like that. It's things that are key to your program, but yet are not maybe under your direct responsibility that is in your contract. But if you want to be successful, it's the things that you got to do. And so I love the fact that you're involved in it. And talk a little bit about how deeply you get involved. You mentioned how you work with, you know, some of the coaches who are involved in your overall program. So talk about how you talk with coaches about how they're going to work with your youth kids.
Yeah. I just finished my 15th year at West and, or my 14th year at West, excuse me, starting my 15th. And two of those 14 years, I've coached an AAU team directly, and there were two times I did it. My first year down here, I knew I had a really good group of sophomores as inheriting. I knew I had a really good group of going to be eighth graders. And so I knew I needed those eighth graders to be ready their freshman year because there's a really talented bunch. And so I coached them myself that year. And then the year 2010, when I lost we had four Division I kids in that team, we had another pretty good eighth grade class, and I knew I needed them ready. So those two classes were the only ones I've coached directly. Even with my daughter coming through, she started playing in second grade with our AAU program. I never coached her team directly as the head coach. And the reason being is if I'm coaching one team directly, like this year we had eight AAU teams in our program from third through eighth grade. I'm going to miss – with my commitments to one team, I'm going to miss a lot of the others because we're going to be playing at the same times on different courts, et cetera, or different gyms across town. So I would miss too many of the kids, but I can't mentor and help my coaches at the same time. So basically I run everything, I organize everything. And then I hop benches all weekend and I hop courts during practice. We have three courts that run side by side. And then actually two in our second gym. So we have five courts running for practice. And so I'm just hopping all the time and jumping in, assisting, answering questions, helping mentor our coach, making sure they're communicating, making sure they're not having one-on-one conversations when 15 kids can't hear and aren't paying attention. and then during the games, I mean, there's times in games where I'll take over a little bit. We never do it to step on toes, never show a coach up. Again, it's always in a respectful, I don't ever get caught up. Like our seventh grade coach is not the lowest of our coaches. That might be my second best coach. Freshman level might be my second best coach. We're really big on all of us being coaches and all of us helping out. And so I'm just always trying to help mentor those levels, but it also allows me to hop bench to bench, and I get to be, you know, I get to be the one high-fiving the kids. I get to be the one having the private conversation with them on the bench about what they could do better rather than coaching the five on the four. And so I take a director role in the AAU season and almost kind of an assistant coach slash mentor role with the rest of my coaches.
When you're trying to help your coaches think about what's the best way to develop those kids as individuals and as a team, what are some things that you try to get them to do, whether it's building something into the practice plan or the way that they communicate? What are some things that you see as being key to making sure that that experience for, let's say, a fifth grade girl that's part of your AAU program, what are some things that you try to get across to the coach in terms of what you want to see to maximize that fifth grade girl's experience as part of the AAU program?
You know, it there's a lot to it, because obviously you might have a really talented class, you might have a not so good. So it's making sure they're not hung up in winning a trophy each weekend. I'm far more concerned with growth. Sometimes you'll have a real talented group, but they didn't grow a lot that year. And then I'm kind of on our coaches about, okay, you just got exposed because you used to run through a press, just giving it to your guard and going. Now this team's better and they exposed you because you don't have your press break in like you should. And so we have what we call our principles of our program, kind of stole Roy Williams, watching him practice years ago, about if we just play our principles when things break down, we'll be fine. And so, you know, we refer to them as, we have a lot of principles that I kind of outlined to our coaches. I kind of created a spreadsheet of benchmarks of what each grade level should be able to do by the end of AAU season, that for fourth grade, for fifth grade, for sixth grade. So our coaches are kind of teaching to that standard, coaching to that standard, getting kids ready. Again, you'll have some kids that naturally surpass some of those. You'll have some kids that couldn't hit them for 2 years beyond that.
Right.
But it's the global perspective of it. I always want our coaches, a couple weeks into the season, you're just scrambling to get ready for the first game. After the first game's up and running, you know, and a couple tournaments under our belts, I'm always giving them feedback of, okay, don't forget to add this. Make sure we need this. They're getting this. Let's work more on our man. Let's back off on the press a little bit. Your guys' weak hands are really poor. Make your kids, you know, handle it more in practice. And so I give them kind of an outline structure of what practices should consist of. I'm also always telling them, hey, let me know when you need drills. Some of my young coaches are really great about, hey, coach, we really struggled when they trapped us on the sideline this weekend. What could we do? Or our traps are really soft. What could we do? And so then I get to give them some drills and you know, expand their palette as coaches as well. And so those are always times when we were working on things. But then just simple back to cultural pieces. Like one of our big things this year, I watched all of our AU teams play. And a big thing for me is you always point after you get an assist from somebody, from a teammate, you acknowledge the assist. And I watched all of our teams play, and I think I won the entire weekend. And so I was a little pissed that we hadn't instilled that and demanded that of our kids, that was unacceptable. So I kind of got on our coaches about it, but then I also went and got on the kids about it, because I feel like some of the older groups that had heard it but didn't make it a priority. And running over our team should never have to get up off the floor by themselves. You better sprint over and help them up. If a teammate of the other team is down and a whistle blows, helping them up. And so there's a lot of little things about the way I want our kids to conduct themselves that we just got a little, you know, you get so caught up in trying to teach the game, sometimes we forget the little things. And so you're constantly evolving and trying to keep those things and bring them all up to speed of where we should be.
Yeah, I've said this before on the podcast, but one of the things that I've always struggled with as a coach, and I think I probably still struggle with it today, is I'll get something that, you know, and I haven't coached at the high school level now for probably 10 years, but I'm coaching mostly my kids' AAU season. So we're practicing, you know, maybe once or twice a week and then playing in our tournaments. And one of the things that always happens to me is I'll inevitably have some standard or something that I want to make sure that we do. And I have to be very, very intentional about making sure that I do that. Just as an example, you mentioned picking a kid up off the floor. And so I might talk about that on day one of practice. And then I get caught up in day to day of we're working on this or we're doing that, kind of like what you described with your youth coaches and the fact that, you know, kids weren't thanking the passer. And sometimes if you're not intentional, then those things that maybe are important to you sometimes get away from you. I know I'm guilty of that as a coach. So for anybody who's out there, I think what I hear you saying is that you have to have these things that they're non-negotiable. This is what we do. This is how we do it. And then it has to be something that's front of mind all the time to make sure that it gets taught. And I think that goes to whether you're coaching a second grade team or you're coaching a high school varsity team. When you're intentional about what you're trying to do and you're putting your practices together and when you're thinking about how you want your team to run, I think the more intentional you can be about those things, the better results you're going to get and the more likely you are to have the things that you want to occur actually occur out on the floor or on the practice gym.
Yeah, and I actually got into an online debate with a pretty well-known regionally sport high school prep writer, and he was on this talent standard and how talent precedes culture. And we got in a debate. I'm like, no, talent doesn't precede culture in building a program, because talent can come and go. And if you're going to coach the talent, you're going to be at the bottom and you'll be at the top. You'll be a roller coaster. Your culture has to be non-negotiable, and your principles, your expectations, your cultural pieces are non-negotiable. And then as talent comes through, that's when you have your special teams. But you can't waver in that talent and compromise and cater to talent just because they're talented. You can't have two sets of standards.
Yeah, I agree with you there 100%. I think that we just talked to Kevin Sutton from the University of Rhode Island, who's coached at a bunch of different levels. And we said to him, and we talked a little bit about how important it is to make sure that you're making decisions based on what you believe to be in the best interest of your program. Because ultimately, if, as you said, you cater to talent or you give in on things, inevitably those players that you give into where you think, oh, I'm going to keep this player happy or I need to keep them in my program. And just like you mentioned off the top, when you had to get rid of, you know, five players in the middle of a road trip because they didn't live up to the standard, had you back down from that and said, well, you know, we really need them. We're at this tournament and we, you know, we can't get rid of them because of this and that. Ultimately, those kids are all going to leave or they're going to burn you in some way, or it's just going to end up watering down your program. And what I said to Coach Sutton was that I really think that if you're doing things right as a coach, not everybody's going to like you. There's going to be people that are going to be upset with you because you're going to make difficult decisions and you're going to hold people to standards that they may not want to be held to. And some people, those standards aren't for them. And then those people are going to go somewhere else. And even if they're very, very talented, eventually, if you choose culture over talent or you choose program over player, you're going to end up in a much better place, because eventually you're going to get players, you're going to get talent who not only are going to be talented players, but they're also going to fit into your culture and buy into what it is that your program's all about. And I think you get in trouble when you start to compromise those principles and those expectations that you have for the culture of your program.
Yeah, I completely agree.
So if we start looking at what you're doing now with your high school team, and you and I got into a discussion in our pre-podcast call talking a little bit about some of your more basketball specific philosophies. And one of the things we talked about was the fact that you teach your entire team to shoot the ball off the hop rather than the 1-2 step. So I think now is a good time for us to kind of get into that, talk a little bit about how you came to believe that, how you go about teaching that. And maybe I'll try to provide my counter argument to why I've always kind of taught, especially with younger kids, the 1-2, and we can kind of get into a lively debate, because I know coaches out there have different philosophies about what is the correct way to teach shooting and what may be best for one person versus another. And so let's just kind of get into that discussion, talk a little bit about how you came to believe that the hop was best, and then describe the success that you've had with it in your program so that people have an idea of where you're coming from.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. You know, that we actually teach the hop all the way down through third grade.
I was always a 10 toes to the rim inside pivot coach. That's what I'd studied. That's what I learned. That's what I That's basically all I found out there. And to me, that was the absolute right way to shoot. I started getting information about the hop and the turn, and some of them were together, some were separate. And I'm like, why would you do this? This is dumb. These guys don't know what they're doing. You know, kind of that style of thinking, because I didn't want to change. I thought I had learned and spent so much time learning to teach the right way to my kids that this couldn't be right. And so, I started looking at it a little bit more, trying to shoot down the mystique of it. And, you know, there's always new gadgets, new gimmicks, and new this and new that. And as I studied it, it made sense. And the premise behind it is, what do we teach versus what do the greatest shooters in the world, what are their common fundamentals, and do they coincide? And they weren't coinciding. I would look at and say probably less than 2% of elite shooters shoot with 10 toes of the basket. And it's funny, because you'll see, I've seen videos of like Steve Kerr and some of these saying, Steph Curry, that, you know, point your toes to the basket. Their toes aren't to the basket. Their toes are to 11 o'clock. They have a slight stagger to their feet. And then the hop part, at first when we tried, oh my gosh, it'd be hard to revamp our whole program to do this. So I had a group that was teaching it come in, and I had 11 varsity turners, and I said, hey, give this clinician 3 hours. Let's see what this is about. And the whole time I wanted it to fail. I wanted to say, nope, this sucks.
Right.
I was right.
Let's move on to what I already know.
I've been doing it right all along. And all 11 kids across the board right after told me, coach, I feel quicker. I feel straighter. I feel more comfortable. Well, you know, 11 kids saying that to you and saying those key things about their shot, it's like, crap, I got to look at this. And so I really started studying and getting more involved with it. And Doc Shepler has become a very, very good friend of mine. He's a high school coaching legend up in Los Altos Hills at Pinewood High School. And he's been on it for years, picked it up from Lute Olson years ago. And Doc's maniacal in his teaching of it and the biomechanics of the way the body works and efficiency. And so he and I have obsessively kind of shared and discussed and tweaked over the last 6 to 8 years, and different drills and different techniques. But it's all on the same premise of the hop. And I feel that it's taken our program to a whole nother level. We're in the dead center of Central California. We don't have the populations of the Bay Area or Orange County. We don't have the mega privates with 2,500 to 3,500 kids and 6'3" studs, all Americans walking around. We have to be able to do some things differently, because just doing what they do at a lesser rate, we're not going to be successful. So, we put a lot of time into our defense, put a lot of time into our shooting, and we're going to have, I think, 14 kids playing college basketball next year. I believe it's 9 at the Division I level, between freshmen through seniors in college next year. And most of those are shooters. I think it's taken our poor shooters and made them average to good and good to great. Absolutely. I even had one person try to argue that a 1-2 is quicker, which is, you know, now you're in a foolish state of mind to say that the 1-2 is quicker. You can have different arguments why you like 1-2 over hop, but quicker is not one of them. So definitely 100% like the quickness of it. I think it really impacts us like at the next level, the state level, the elite teams, because the closeouts are longer and faster. The defense closes so much faster that you need to get that shot off quicker. The hop isn't rushing. The hop's already quick. So I have to remind kids when they're first learning, don't try to shoot quick. You're already quicker. I love the fact that with the 1-2, you need more space to get your shot off. And a lot of kids, not only do they pivot to do a 1-2 inside pivot, but they take a big step with their first step. And so now they need 6 feet to get their shot off, plus the space between the defender, and then attacking closeouts. You know, we teach our kids on any skip pass, you're hopping to shoot or you're hopping to attack. And so we land split and are attacking, try to attack closeouts, take advantage of the defensive changes and rules over the last several years, where every elbow and forearm and second touch is a foul. So it's just so much quicker. It goes with the balance of everything. biomechanically, the tempo and pace of everything that we do. So, I mean, it's funny because coaches will go, God, your kids shoot so quickly. I love their release. Well, you know, are they really shooting faster, or is it the tempo of the hop versus a 1-2? So that's really, you know, one of the things people say is, you know, young kids aren't strong enough. My daughter started doing it in third grade, fourth grade, and she was looked like a noodle shooting a basketball. I mean, she was skinny as a rail. And, you know, sixth grade, she's shooting hop threes and shooting pretty consistently. And before that, in fifth grade, she's shooting 17 footers off the hop very consistently. And so it's really not a strength thing. It's a tempo thing. And it's getting kids to understand that tempo. We'll have coaches we play and they're screaming travel, travel, travel every time because it's different, you know, and it's like, you know, I'll be the first one to get on our kids when they travel because I cannot stand turnovers. And really, with all the work we do on it, if you travel, you're just being lazy. So, I mean, we do 35 minutes plus of competitive shooting every day in practice, and it's teaching the entire time. We're constantly walking around and talking to them about their tempo, their foot, their release, their ball location, their index finger, their... So it's constant reinforcement. And you can't just say, hey, we're going to do hop shooting. Here's a clinic. Okay, now shoot that way the rest of your career. we are constantly on them about their feet.
All right. So I have three things. First thing is I'm just going to reiterate what you just said, which is your feet. It goes to, regardless of what you believe, whether you believe in the hop or you believe in the 1-2, your feet are critically important to your success as a basketball player. So if you are a basketball player that is out there listening, regardless of what you end up doing, your feet are critically important. And the best players in the world, male, female, high school, college, pro, whatever, they have great footwork. So that's number one. Number two, I think that what I hear you saying is that it's not something that you can just throw out there for an hour, 2 hours, and suddenly think that you're going to have it down and you're going to have it mastered. You as a coach and your coaching staff is constantly reinforcing what it is that you're going to do. So I have two things related to that. And the first one is, how do you go about initially introducing the hop to a young kid? So what are some of the introductory things that you do when you talk about it with a second or third grade player? And then the second part of that question is, what are some basic drills, some simple things that if a high school coach is listening and they're interested in picking up a competitive shooting drill or two, what are one or two things that you do that are your favorite ways of putting your kids in a competitive situation when it comes to shooting?
Yeah. So in terms of starting with the young kids, we start with the form. We want to get the hand placement correct on the ball in the correct shooting pocket. We want the feet turned so that your hip and index finger and elbow are all in alignment. So, you know, we'll get them working on shooting correctly first, stationary. Once they're doing that, before we have them catching or doing anything, because, you know, adding the catch to the hop is obviously a little crazy. We actually have them do kind of a double hop stationary. And so they'll hop, and on the second hop, they go right into their shot. And it's, you know, you throw out the disclaimer up front, guys, this is a travel.
Right. Right, exactly. Game. I've done lots of drills like that where you know, you're like, okay, we're going to do this and we're going to pivot and we're dribbling. And this is clearly a double dribble, but we're working on this, or this footwork is clearly a travel, but here's what we're trying to accomplish with your balance and your feet. So I completely relate to what you're saying.
And you see NBA, I mean, if you see actual, not shooting workouts, but actual NBA shooting coaches working with guys, they're doing stuff where they're facing the hoop, hop 90 degrees, hop back and shoot, because they're working on that balance and finding the rim off the turn. And you're incorporating a lot more things than just a double hop. But we start with that double hop, so they start to get the feel of it. Then we will incorporate the 90-degree double hop, where they hop basically turn their feet from the baseline to the sideline and back to the baseline for their shot. Then we'll progress up to, with the little ones, we have a coach soft toss it to them. As they get older, there'll be a teammate passing them, but we'll have a coach soft toss it to them. So they're working on catching and catching the ball in flight so that they're not catching then hopping. People refer to it as the bunny hop. but half those people don't realize that when you hop clean, they still say it's a bunny hop and travel. It's like, no, it wasn't. She caught it in the air.
Right.
But you're programming and training it to, that's the only thing you do. That's the only thing, you know, if you're shot ready, you're never caught with your feet on the ground. And so, you know, you've never seen a shooter with their hands down, standing stiff legged, you know, a shooter has their target hand up and wants the ball. And so working on those feet, the phrase we use with our kids is all the time is, you don't put your hand on a hot stove and think about it and process and go, ow, that burns. I got to get my hand off. I mean, the second you put your hand on a hot stove, you're firing it away. We want our feet to fire like that on our shot. We don't want your feet to come to a rest and lose the tempo and energy you've created. As soon as those feet come down from your catching in the air, we want those toes and ankles to fire and right back up into your shot. And so you're drilling that quickness will progress into a self flip hop that they can do at home, where they're literally, I don't like when they're spinning the ball out to themselves, letting it bounce once and then catching it, because that's when they start to hop late. They're not used to. So we get rid of the ball hitting the floor on that. So they're basically soft tossing to themselves, just about eye level or above, right into their shot. Then we'll get into some quick fire stuff with them, where they're actually doing like a defensive quick fire and getting into their shot. And all these, when we do these with the older kids, we start every day at 6 feet and progress back to three. And so we have about 8 different quick hop shooting warm-up drills that we do, and we just do a different one kind of every day. And so it's just, we do it off the move, off the bounce, stationary, double hop, just all these different things, kind of working them from all angles. Because I've had some say, oh, on a straight kick out from the post, that's when I hop. But if they're on the move or from a pass from the point to the wing, I have them 1-2. Well, why would you intentionally tell a training kid to shoot differently? And so we work on all that. Our kids are doing it off the move, off the fade, off the flare, off the curl, stationary, et cetera. And so drilling all that all the way up. But that's how we start with the little ones. If anybody listening to the broadcast is ever interested, feel free to email me at Clovis West High School. Happy to share. I've got a bunch of – we've got a ton of videos. I'm trading video shooting drills all the time with college coaches. And our first 35 minutes is all competitive shooting. So it's all timed and scored. And what's great about it is after a month of shooting – you've got all these scores compiled. The seventh kid on your team, if she wants to wonder why number one and two are getting all the threes, well, you're seventh on our team in threes. It's consistent across the board. You can see what your role is and who your better shooters are. They're completing a 5-minute drill in 2.5 minutes that you're not even completing in 5 minutes. And so we've got all these different time score type of drills that are competitive. Our kids enjoy them. There's a winner and a loser. It's either individual or small group. Losers sprinted down and back or two down and backs, and then we're on into our next drill. And so we do about, we've probably got 15 to 20 of those types of drills, and we do about 2 or 3 of them per day plus our warm-up. We go 2.5 hours of practice every day, and at least minimum 35 minutes is dedicated to shooting, but it's all game speed shooting. Even our hop warm-up drills are all game speed.
So what's a give me a specific competitive drill that you set up, that one that you love, one that's simple to explain, because obviously if we had video right now, you could, you know, throw up a video and it's
sure
easier for people to see. But give us one maybe verbally that you can explain that's fairly simple that you think would be beneficial for a team to try or for a coach to incorporate into their practice.
Okay, so here's a good one. We do this drill called 99 cent store, and it's a 5-minute drill. You have one passer, one ball. So every three you make is worth, every shot you make is worth three, and you're trying to get 33 makes in 5 minutes. The flip side of it is every two consecutive misses that you have, you lose three. So what I really like about the drill is you'll have a kid hit 5 in a row, so they're at 15. Then they'll go 0 for 12. And in a lot of drills, you're still at 15. Well, you go 0 for 12 in this drill, you're back down to 0. And so it really makes the kids feel that time and score pressure of, you know, if you go stone cold and want to pout, your score is going to plummet quickly.
Right. You got to be able to bounce back.
Yeah. You got to shoot through it. You got to shoot through the cold spells. And so our better kids, the kids we've had in the last 3 years, they're in the 230 to 240 range, meaning they still have 220 on the clock when they've hit their 33 shots. They're shooting at about a 33 out of 36, 37 clip. Other kids on our team, same varsity kids, some of them will have 21 after 5 minutes. Some of them will have in the 60s after 5 minutes. And so when you're trying to get kids again to understand the level of an elite shooter to you, you got 24. She was done with 220 left on the clock. And so we call that one 99 cent drill. You get 99 points, 33 makes in 5 minutes. But that key of that one is losing three for every two consecutive misses.
So you have a player rebounding in that case and kicking passes back out. How is that set up?
So you're shooting, I'm rebounding. Every time you shoot, you just got to move about 3 feet to your around the perimeter. You'll just kind of keep rotating in a half circle, but you're not sliding or running. You're just shooting, move 3 feet, shooting, move 3 feet. I just run and rebound and feed you. And you're also working on communication in your practice during that drill and all of our drills. I have to keep track of your score and yell it out the entire time. Just kind of working on, you know, not having a quiet gym, getting kids to communicate, talk, pick your teammate up. You know, are you being a good teammate? Your teammate has missed 12 in a row. Have you said a word to them? Are they hopping late and traveling, but coaches at the other end and you don't say a word to them? You know, so holding each other accountable in those drills as well, picking each other up in those drills. But, you know, you start to get a great gauge and kids can measure them. You know what? We'll have kids that get the 33 makes in 5 minutes, but they had 30 seconds left and are pissed because normally they have 2 minutes left. Right. So they start to know what's good and what's not good for themselves as well. And so we start to put extra things on it. Like if they don't at least complete it in 5 minutes, they got two down and backs. If you're not within 30 seconds of your best score, you have two down and backs. And so that they're not, I beat it once, now I get to coast the rest of the year. So we're constantly raising the bar on them.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love the idea of what you said, that you're thinking about the communication piece of it too. And there's always, I think this is one of the things that the best coaches do, is when you're running a practice and you may be doing a rebounding drill or you might be doing a shooting drill, but there's other small, subtle things that can be a part of it that goes back to what I said earlier. I think if you're intentional about the way that you go about planning your practices or putting together your drills, that you can take advantage of situations like what you just described, where, yeah, here it is, we're working on a competitive shooting drill, but we can also get better at communicating as a team. You could also get better as the rebounder of just telling the kid who's rebounding, hey, start to look at where the ball is going and how coming off and try to anticipate and be ready to help your teammate. And those are things that kids could take for granted, and coaches, we can take it for granted sometimes too. But if we do go ahead and mention those things to kids before the drill starts, hey, we want you to communicate. Hey, watch the flight of the ball off your teammate's hand and where it's going to hit on the rim and try to anticipate where that rebound is going to go. And those are things that add value to a drill that's already a good drill, but now we've made it even better because we've made it more game. Like, we put you in situations where you're thinking about multiple things, just like you would in a game. And basketball, obviously, we know is a dynamic sport where decision-making is key and being able to react to what goes on around you is the key to success. And so the more we can put our kids into those kinds of situations, the better off they are. And I love how you're incorporating multiple things into that drill.
Yeah, and even the standpoint, sometimes we have to remind them, you know, we're so anal on our shooting system that we teach, but what about your passing? Just because you throw it into their catch radius doesn't mean it was a great pass, you know, and so, you know, reminding them about, you know, not floating passes or throwing it at their shins, but delivering a great pass throughout.
Absolutely.
The drill. I tell our kids, when I stand at midcourt during the drills, I need to know what your score is. So we have 8 hoops in our gym, so I better be able to hear that far corner hoop just like I can the one I'm right in front of. So that means you got to be yelling it. You got to be communicating and talking, not just saying it, but yelling it.
So when you're running a drill like that, how many assistant coaches do you have in your varsity practice? Does your varsity practice with your JV? Do you practice separate? How do you have your practices set up? And then how many coaches, how many sets of eyeballs do you have on your kids while you're practicing?
We have, at the varsity level, we'll always have 3 to 4 assistants. So we'll have myself plus a total staff of 4 to 5, counting myself. our JV and Frosh practice together. There's usually a head coach and maybe kind of a floater assistant between them. But at the high school, at the varsity level, there's usually four or five of us. I'm constantly, especially when I get a new coach, either moving them up from a lower level or somebody new to our program, I'll be going by a lot and say, "Hey, coach, like, I'm not even here." And they'll kind of look at me. I'm like, "Coach, like, I'm not even here." They'll walk over and go, "God, nobody's boxing out." I'll blow this. I'll go, "Go, tell them." You know, they need to hear other voices. And as coaches want to grow, you've got to step out of your comfort zone of complaining to me and take an initiative. And so our coaches are really good. And we have such a good staff. We really feed off each other. One coach will jump in and get on their rebounding, but I'm watching their defense. Another coach is watching how our turnovers. And so, you know, we just kind of start feeding all this. We all have our pet peeves, our strengths, our quirks as coaches. And if you get four or five people, you know, throwing out input like that, I just think we're giving the kids so much more to learn rather than, you know, just my way or the highway all the time. You know, I'll make the tough calls at the end of the day. But, you know, I want our coaches' input. You know, that's how I grow as a coach and that's how they grow.
Right, absolutely. You want your coaches to be coaching, yep, and not just be standing there and being a figurehead.
Yeah,
and
they're not managers.
That's exactly right. And talk a little bit about, and you just mentioned one aspect of it where you're going through and you're modeling what you want them to be doing in terms of how they're interacting with the players during a drill or during practice. Talk about what your responsibilities are, what you feel your responsibilities are to your assistant coaches in terms of helping them to develop and become better coaches. What are some things that you do directly for your assistant coaches to help them develop and grow as coaches?
Well, you know, I like to give and gather feedback. I'm always kind of bouncing ideas. So like when we're scouting a team, I'll ask coaches, "Hey, so tell me, what do you think? Hey, how good is 42? What do you guys think? Hey, can we press these guys? What do you think?" And I'll ask, a lot of times I'll ask them individually. And we have group messages that we do, but I want that individual feedback from them where they're having to dissect and pick apart the game. Giving them in practice, I'll have them, "Hey, you take the black team today, you take the gold team." I end up yelling at both teams. So I'll say, "Hey, I have black," and all of a sudden I'm on gold. And, you know,
right.
So,
I've been there many times.
But trying to give them some responsibility in practice. Summertime, a lot of times, I like, depending on what we have back to it, if there's a group of young kids that I know I need to jump in and mold, you know, I take on a bigger role. If we're going to play in a tournament that's just so, sometimes I'll take a step back and tell them, "Hey, you coach the black team, which is our top team, you coach the gold team." And I kind of assist, well, kind of like what I do with our AAU program. So I try to get them to help grow through game experience as well. I'll ask them, "Hey, what do you guys think? What do we need to spend more time on in practice?" And they'll say, "Hey, you know, we haven't spent any time on the press in the last 2 days. And, you know, we're starting to, our closeouts are terrible." Or so getting that feedback from them and getting that investment from them. You know, you touched on earlier, I don't know if many people understand what really goes on behind the scenes. And a lot of times, even, you know, until you're a head coach, I don't know if you know, even if you've been an assistant for a long time, all the, you know, because we have to do the parent meetings, the scheduling, this fundraising, the you know, a kid screwed up and you have a discipline issue, you got to go meet with the kid and you know, the principal or whatever. And so, you know, those are the things that can also burn coaches out. And, you know, I think some people, as they go through this profession, you know, everybody at first wants to be a head coach, but some realize that, you know, the fun stuff sometimes is being the assistant.
I
you know,
agree.
Especially if you're in a program where you do have a voice and you do have value. And, you know, our coaches, I would hope, feel that voice and value in our program. And so I like to take on the stuff that sucks so they can just enjoy, you know, doing the parts of it that they love.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think sometimes, you know, you take for granted as an assistant what all the head coach has to do. And I spent 13 or 14 years as a varsity assistant coach, the first 12 with the same, we had the exact same staff, same head varsity coach, myself as the varsity assistant, and then we had the same JV coach. And it was a situation exactly like you described, where I felt like I had input. I felt like I was valued. I felt like I got to coach. And yet, to your point, I didn't have to do all those sort of drudgery, you know, that type of work that our head coach had to do. And when I first got to my job where I teach now, and that's where I coached, and I thought, oh, I'm going to be here a year or two, and then I'm going to go on and be a head coach somewhere else. And for various reasons, it ended up not being the path that I chose and that I followed. Instead, I ended up being an assistant coach. And to be honest, I loved it because I loved the piece of it that I got to do, which was the actual coaching out on the floor and some of those other responsibilities that I may not have had time for or didn't want to do, I didn't have to do as the assistant coach. And so I felt like my head coach did a fantastic job of empowering me to be able to do the things that I enjoyed doing and that I was good at. And the things that were his responsibility, he kind of did them behind the scenes without me even necessarily being aware of, just like you said, aware of all those things that he may have had to do. Talk a little bit about let's maybe go through a typical, let's say, a year in the life of Coach Campbell, and talk about what are some of the things that maybe you do that a parent may not be aware of, or the average high school basketball fan may not be aware of as you go through, like in the fall, what are some things that you're doing during the season? What are some things you're doing in the spring and the summer that the average person who watches a high school basketball game may not be aware of?
Yeah. And actually, you know, I mean, as you well know, people think, oh, fall's the start of things. It's like, no, back in mid-March is the start of things.
Right, exactly.
Right after we finished our season.
Right, no doubt.
And so, you know, right after our season ends, we literally the year we won state 2 years ago, and we finished number one in the country in three polls that year. We won the state championship on Saturday, and on Monday night, we're in the gym with 75 of our AAU kids starting our AAU program. And so we start that the next, literally, so when our high school kids finish, you know, they get a little break for a little while. Our high school coaches, our staff is right back in the gym the next week with our feeder system. And so mid-March through Memorial Weekend, our high school coaches, our staff, myself will all be doing AAU two nights a week and weekend tournaments. So seven of their weekends will be consumed traveling for AAU. A lot of terms are local, but playing every weekend. I will be not only setting up our AAU registration, getting everybody signed up, organizing them into teams, but then we host a tournament that has anywhere, depending on the year, from 65 to 90 teams. So I'm doing all the scheduling, collecting teams, advertising, simultaneously getting our summer schedule ready for our high school team. We'll start practicing with our high school at the end of April again, into May, getting ready for summer league and summer tournaments. So I'm doing that while simultaneously getting our schedule ready for the next season. We host a tournament in the summer, an AAU tournament in the spring, and a winter tournament. So I'm soliciting teams for all of those simultaneously and scheduling, trying to get all that done. So once we get to May, we're doing double duty with our AAU program and our feeder kids. And then into June, once June hits, we go 4 days a week for 2 hours of skill work and followed by an hour of strength training Monday through Thursday. We play two games a night, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then we travel Friday through Sunday and get games in. And then once July hits, we set our kids off with our club teams. When they're in town, we'll still do skill work and weights. But that's their opportunity to kind of go, you know, get some more exposure, more competition, hear a different voice. August slows down a little, but not much, because it's gotten to the point where we tell them, August is your time. If you want in the gym, let me know. I'm not going to ask you to be there or wonder where you are if you're not. But we will have now 8, 9, 10 varsity kids every year. Coach, can we shoot tomorrow? Coach, can we get in the gym tomorrow? Coach, can you work me out tomorrow? So, you know, it's a nice problem to have. You've got committed kids that love it, and you know that's why you do it. But it does lead to no downtime for them. And I just tell them, I said, you got to know what you need. If you some of you love the game, some of you like the game, and both are okay. But I always tell them, don't want love the game results with like the game commitment, because that's not you're not being fair. Don't give 80% and 100, or give 70% and 100. So. So once we get to August, where we are right now, just getting our fall practice schedule, we're lifting and working out, but getting our fall practices and trying to get, I'm pretty anally organized. And so we like to get all the information out to the parents of what October, November, December practice schedule will be like, so they can plan days that we're, you know, making travel arrangements. We're going to South Carolina next year. We try to go, last year we went to Hawaii and to Florida. This year we're going to San Diego and to South Carolina. So we're making all those travel arrangements, hotels. You know, once schedules start coming out, then we'll start collecting tape on everybody and developing scouting reports. Then we have a fall camp that we'll be working towards getting promoting. Oh, we had a summer camp in between there. And then our Little Hoopsters program, you know, 360 kids takes a lot of promoting, a lot of organization on our part, getting them all broken up into teams and getting the numbers right and emailing. And so we do all that through the season. And then we're, you know, right back into a high school season and start it all over again in March.
Sounds like you got a lot of free time. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, tons. My wife will tell you tons.
Again, I don't think people have a concept of how much time it takes to run a successful program at the high school level today. I think if you go back 20 or 30 years, you had a certain baseline in terms of the amount of time that a coach put in, where, yeah, you put in your time during the season and, you know, maybe you show up to a couple summer league games and you open up the gym occasionally in the summer. And now the baseline has been raised up so much in terms of what's expected of a high school coach, and then somebody like yourself who's going above and beyond and is involved in the youth program and is involved in AAU and is involved in all these, in every facet of their program, people just have no idea of the amount of time day to day that a guy like you is putting in. And I think that's, you know, there's a reason why you're successful, and it's by investing time. And when you're investing time, you're investing in the relationships with your players, your coaching staff, your school, your community. And that shows, and it shows in success, not only on the court, but I'm sure it shows in the relationships that you built with kids who are calling you 10, 20 years after that you've been their coach and sharing things with you about their life and all that stuff. It just, when you invest time in people and you pour into them, you end up getting great results, and you end up getting great results on the floor, and you also end up getting great results with their life. And that's really what having an impact on them through the game of basketball is all about. I want to jump from this to talk about sort of the unique situation that you've had the past couple of years and let you talk about this, because I think there's some unique dynamics here with you having an opportunity to coach your daughter, and now your daughter's heading into her freshman year at USC. So let's start by talking about what it was like to coach her. What were some of the challenges, and what were some of the joys of getting the opportunity to coach your daughter as her high school coach?
Well, you know, having her fall in love with the game early on was really cool. You know, she has a twin brother. They both kind of did everything growing up, and then he kind of went more football, and which, you know, I also love. And but she was, you know, she fell in love with the game of basketball. And, you know, I knew she was pretty good. I didn't know what level until about eighth grade. I took her up to Cal Stars, is a national Nike sponsored UIBL program, one of the top in the country every year. And I remember the first practice I took her to try out for that team, because it was time to find her something bigger than the Central Valley had to offer at the time. And Coach Sopak comes up to me, the head coach of the upper levels, and he goes, "You know she's really good, right?" And I'm like, "Well, I know she's pretty good, but you know, right. how good? Who knows?" And and he goes, "No, she's going to be a Pac-12 kid." You know, and this is back entering eighth grade, and or middle of eighth grade is when she tried out for them. And, you know, at that point on, you know, I started seeing what she was capable of. And, you know, she went from at that point, a 5'8" kind of lanky, 5'7" kind of lanky guard, and grew to 5'11" by her freshman year. and, you know, was a string bean as a freshman, but started getting stronger. She went through it, and she came into the program at a right time when we had her freshman year. We had a really talented group of juniors, a couple good seniors. She was a part of a good class, and it was her sophomore year that we went 34-2. We beat 9 of the top 15 in the country that year. And won the, our open division state champion. We beat, I think it was 7 McDonald's All-Americans that year. And it was funny because everywhere we went, we didn't pass the eye test. I mean, we were playing, right. You know, the six. So I told somebody at one point, I said, the difference is they all have McDonald's All-Americans and my kids like to eat at McDonald's. And, you know, that was just, but all of our kids could handle it. They could all shoot it. We ran, jumped all over the court. And we got people out of their comfort zone and into a style that, you know, they thought they wanted to play, but, you know, it, unless you practice that way, it didn't bode well for them. So we were in the Nike TOC, which is the top high school tournament in the country for girls. And we were playing in the national division, and we beat like number 3 in the country, number 8 in the country, number 12 in the country, and get to the championship against Miami Country Day, who, we were the only loss that year, and we were in a tight game with about, I think they cut it to 2 with about 6.5 to go. And Maddie caught fire in the last 5-6 minutes of the game and ended up hitting 6 threes in the championship game, and had a, literally we won the game. We ended up beating them by 22 in the last 6.5 minutes. And on our van rides, 10-hour van ride back to Fresno, she got, you know, two Pac-12 phone calls offering her scholarships. And, you know, just right at that game, I was like, she had had probably about, I think she had about 8 offers at that point, but they were all, you know, mid-level. And when she started getting that level, it was like, ooh, this just changed.
Right. You know, exactly. Right.
The whole thing just changed a little bit. And, you know, tried to get her, she's a very, very grounded, humble kid. You know, she's a natural point guard, but she shoots it so damn well that she could, you know, she's going to be a 2 more at the next 2-3 at the next level. But it never really got to her. But I just, in terms of mapping out her options, it was like, okay, well, you have a couple that believe in you after, you know, a great performance on a great stage, but let's, you know, I kind of kept nudging her towards looking at those mid majors, because it just, you don't want to shoot too high.
Right.
And understood. Then, you know, as it was going along, all of a sudden she got to September 1st of her junior year where they can finally call you. And by that point, she had about 18 offers. I figured, oh, she'll probably have about, you know, 22 people. There'll probably be 4 or 5 little outliers that, you know, have interest but haven't offered. And between text, phone, and email, she had like 49 schools contact her. It's like, whoa, where have these guys been? What's going on? You know, you're trying to navigate this whole thing now about who's serious, who's just, you know, keeping her interest there if something else falls through. And so she talked to me in about December or January of her junior year and said, Dad, I really think I want to commit in the spring. And I said, okay, well, you know, are you sure? You know, why do you want to do that? She goes, well, I go, you understand, she had 30 offers at that point. And I said, you understand you'll probably, you know, double or add 20 more if you play the summer before your senior year. I mean, that's usually the big summer for everyone. She goes, I just want it over and I want to focus on getting better. And I said, you know, what if another school came in last minute or whatever? She goes, I've got so many that I like that I have good relationships with. She goes, I'm happy with what I have. And so we knocked out her official visits in the spring. She planned on taking 5. And then she went to Indiana, loved it. And had always, USC had always been her number one, or, you know, right, one of the ones. And those two were a month apart. And she decided to push everything else after USC. And after she went to USC, she's like, Dad, I want to commit here. And I said, okay, but you're not doing it on the trip. You know, I told all the coaches up front, I said, she's not committing on a visit. We're going to go home, let her process it, let her think about it, let her compare. And, you know, I 2 days later, she's like, Dad, I want to commit. And she had a hard time. I mean, Indiana was a perfect fit for her. I mean, she could have been the great staff, great visit, great program. But she just felt like, I remember USC head coach Track was talking to her and said, you know, Maddie, what kind of timeline are you looking at? And she said, I'll probably know within 2 weeks. And he said, okay. He goes, I just want you to know. And this was Memorial weekend. He goes, I just want you to know if you need until September, you have a ride with us. And I think that really meant a lot to her, that there wasn't the pressure that she was getting from some other schools and, you know, some schools that had kind of drifted a little bit, and she wasn't getting run around and jerked around and, you know, hey, we love you. And then you don't hear from them for 2 months and you find out they're chasing another kid, and then, oh, hey, you know, we love you. Oh, what happened? Oh, well, we find out they lost out on that other kid, you know, and just, they were genuine. They're upfront. You know, both those staffs were just, what they sold you and what they ended up being were equal. And there's a lot of people that I changed my opinion of through the process of the way, you know, Maddie had 30 offers. She hadn't heard from about 10 of those schools in a while. Some of them had kind of backed off because she got higher offers, may have gone a different way. She reached out to every single school and let them know that she committed before making anything public. And yet, some of the schools that recruit these kids, my daughter and some of these other kids that I've had go through the process, don't return that level of professionalism. And that's a piece that's really disappointing for me as a coach, is every one of them preaches character, relationships, all this and that. Well, how hard is it to reach out to a kid and say, hey, Maddie, we got a commitment from a school, from a kid. You know, we wish you the best, but I just wanted to be upfront with you. I mean, she's finding out on social media that there's no longer an offer for her, you know, and things like that. And we understand how it goes. I mean, she's going to end up picking one school when it's all said and done. We get it. But I think there just needs to be more transparency in the process with some of these schools. But she finished out her recruit, committed in May before her senior year, went into her senior year, only needed, I think, like 16 threes to break the all-time school record that stood since 1993. And was only like 300 points shy of the school scoring record. And what was crazy about it is the number of great kids that not only have been there for me through the 14 years I've been there, but the ones before. You know, we have a WNBA player and Adrian William Strong that played there, and several Pac-12 players. And by the end of her senior year, she was the all-time school leader in scoring, three-pointers made, assist. And craziest stat is she was the all-time school leader in rebounding. And for a 5'11 guard, she always had a nose for the ball. And I think she had like 18 or 20. She averaged a double-double her senior year between rebounding and scoring. But the year prior, junior year, she had like 18 double-doubles and 5 triple-doubles or something like that. So, you know, she's a kid. If she scored 2 points or 22 points, she doesn't care as long as they win. And one of those kids who can genuinely be happy for a teammate having a great night. And her Maddie's junior year, she fouled out in the state quarterfinal game. We were down like 4 and we got the ball back down 2 with like 12 seconds to go. And I didn't feel like we had any chance in overtime with her on the bench. And so we were on a play for a 3 to win it. And one of her best friends on the team buries a 3 to win the game for us. And Maddie's the first one running off the bench, screaming, jumping up and down, elated that her friend hit that, her teammate hit that, and we're still playing. Whereas a lot of kids are probably still butthurt that they are in foul trouble and fouled out of the game and, you know, thinking about themselves. It was just another glimpse of who she is as a person, that none of that mattered. She was just so happy for her teammate and her team.
So how, as you go through this process and you're navigating it, and you had obviously, with the number of players that you've got that have gone through your program that have played college basketball, you've obviously been through that recruiting process before as a coach. So how different was it for you to be playing the dual role of, well, I'm her high school coach, but on the other hand, I'm also her parent? How did that change the dynamic of for you in terms of how you approached conversations with coaches, or how you looked at the process when you were only looking at it from a coaching perspective versus now you're looking at it from two different perspectives, you know, in terms of you playing both roles for your daughter?
You know, I think a lot of times that most people probably thought I would make the decision for her, which is the complete opposite of how the process went. Normally with my players, I would probably be more outwardly talking to the coaches for my other players and maybe less telling them what my thoughts are, kind of letting them navigate it. With her, it was probably the opposite. I don't think I talked to her coaches that were recruiting her as much. I really kind of made her responsible for the phone calls and the tough questions. Like if a kid's kind of, coach, I'm getting a lukewarm feeling from the school, I'll call the school and say, hey, where are you at? Are you guys offering her? Are you not? What are your hesitations? How many kids are you offering? You know, I'll be very direct with them. With Maddie, I kind of pulled back on that. But then I gave her a little bit more input, you know, being dad, of, you know, the goods and bads I saw that she needs to consider. But it was really just giving her information through the process of her making that decision. There was things that she saw when she'd go on unofficial visits, like, Dad, I don't think I can play here. And I'd be like, why? And she said, well, all their jerseys are untucked. The kids are rolling their eyes. They're talking when coach is talking. She goes, that there's just the I don't like the cultural piece here. You know, just little things like that. It was kind of cool to hear her pick up on,
right,
you know, those pieces that she was looking for as a player.
Yeah, it's very cool, because what you hear there is her mirroring what she's grown up in and the type of culture that she has grown up in, and doesn't want to go and sacrifice that culture in a new environment. So that, I'm sure, again, at both levels, as a coach and as a parent, that's something that I'm sure made you feel very proud of, again, not necessarily her as a basketball player, but just her as the type of person that she's going to end up becoming as a result of her involvement in the game of basketball, which is ultimately what's the most important, is the kind of person that she's going to become through the game and what the game has given her and what it gave you in terms of that opportunity to be able to spend all that kind of time with her, the amount of time that you've spent with other players and other people's daughters. And now you have the opportunity to spend that same amount of time with your own daughter and end up having a result that, again, there's a lot of people out there that dream of having the opportunity to have their child be able to play college basketball. And you not only got to experience that, but you also got to coach her along the way and be a huge part of her journey, not just as a parent, but also as a coach. And that's very, very cool. I want to wrap up with one final question related to that. What's she looking forward to the most here as she heads into her freshman year, as you guys have conversations? What's she looking forward to the most in terms of basketball, school, just going to college? What is it that she's most excited about at this moment? If you had to ask her, what do you think she would say?
You know, I think she's looking forward to the challenge. You know, when I first was talking to her, I was like, look, because she had some really, really good mid-majors as well that were probably opportunities to play earlier, you know, than the 13 or so Power 5 conference offers that she had. And, you know, I was always trying to say, you know, do you want to go to this level with an opportunity to play earlier? Or, you know, understanding going to this level, you know, you might not play for a year or two. I mean, and you've played, you've had the ball in your hand most of your life. You know, that's a big adjustment. And she always said, Dad, I want to compete against the best. That's all I've ever done. That's all I've ever known. And so I think she's really competitively driven. And it doesn't matter if you're playing, you know, darts with her or pool basketball or, you know, what you're doing. She is obsessively, I've used the phrase, everybody loves to win. She hates to lose. And there's a difference in those kids that just cannot stomach losing. And so I think she's really looking forward to, they've made a lot of cultural changes at USC in the last couple of years. They got, you know, they're entering their third year as a coaching staff, and they've got high character kids across the board and great families. And I think she's looking forward to being a part of that and helping to swing USC back to, you know, the glory days, and just being a part, whatever that role ends up being for her. You know, whether it's supportive, whether it's a shooter, whether it's, you know, whatever it is. And then I know she's starved to prove herself. You know, being a coach's kid, she's gotten a lot of praise and she's gotten a lot of criticism. And, you know, I remember her saying something in the year, you know, thank you for all my supporters and thank you for all my haters too. You know, you've motivated me too. Cause you know, she won 127 games in, and 127 and 14 in her 4 years as a high school player. You know, she averaged, she won 30 games every single year of her career. And, you know, there's, as you know, any program that wins, you're going to have your people that don't like you because you're winning. Then you're a coach's kid on top of it. Then you're, you know, a four-year All-State player and an All-American on top of it. You know, so, you know, it's a shame that some people are that petty. But, you know, she's a great kid that has earned everything she's gotten. And it's been a special ride with all of our kids. It's extra special going through with your daughter. But she's really looking forward to getting down there with her teammates and you know, building that program into something special.
I can only imagine. It's got to be exciting for her. It's got to be exciting for you. Congratulations to both of you on all the great things that you've accomplished to this point, and I'm sure there's a lot more to come. We're coming up on about an hour and a half here, Craig, so I want to wrap things up by giving you an opportunity to share your contact information. You mentioned earlier just about being willing to share with coaches who are out there who may be listening that are looking for new things that they can add to their bank of practice drills, or maybe they want to just talk culture, or maybe they just you know, want to reach out to you and say thanks for all the great things that you're doing and what you shared here on the podcast. So share your contact information. If there's anything that we didn't hit on, maybe a final parting shot that you'd like to share with our audience, you can do that as well, and then we'll come back and wrap up the episode and say our thanks.
Yeah, no, for sure. Anybody can reach me. You can either go through the Clovis West website and find me on there under the staff directory, or it's just Craig Campbell, all one word, CraigCampbell at CUSD as in dog.com. Email me anytime. You can also check us out on Twitter. We have our Clovis West girls basketball account on there. You could hit me that way as well, whatever's the easiest platform, and happy to share, discuss. I mean, this is how I've learned and grown into the coach I am, is talking to people, stealing things from people, tweaking things. Always happy to help people out. We've had people fly in from Chicago and LA and Florida the last several years and spend the weekend with us, or come and watch practices. And, you know, it's a fraternity and a sorority together, you know, the men and women coaches. And, you know, I'm always willing to learn and always willing to share. You know, I just think for any coaches out there, be true to yourself. Don't compromise for admin pressure, parental pressure. You know, have your expectations be higher than what everybody else can have for you, and stay true to what you believe needs to happen. And if you do that, at the end of the day, you can look in the mirror and know you give it 110%.
That's a great piece of advice to end on. I think it's very, very key to being a successful coach, is making sure that you're doing the things that you believe is right for your program and for your kids. And if you do that, you're going to be able to put your head down on the pillow at night and sleep and know that you're doing the best thing for those kids in the long term. And that's really what it's all about. Craig, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been a lot of fun to be able to talk hoops with you. It's been a lot of fun to learn about the journey that you and Maddie went on together, and that still there's a lot more great things to come, I'm sure. So thank you so much for jumping on with us, and everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoop Heads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.